I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Okay, I'm going to add a little bit more to the intro on this. I just say, like, Nokomoto episode whatever, right? But I don't really say a lot about who we are. So it's Nokomoto episode 17, 18?
Who knows?
I'm losing it. It's 17 or 18, one of those. I think it's 18, which is pretty cool. And we're coming to you from an undisclosed location in northern Colorado. We took advantage of one of our 300 days of sunshine, and we had quite a day of riding, didn't we? Oh, wait, hold on. I'm your host, MotoGP, and with me is Swiggy.
Yo.
Okay. So, yeah, we had quite a ride today, didn't we?
We did.
I'm not exactly entirely clear on where we went still. But basically, we went riding around weird roads south of Boulder, near Golden, in between Boulder and Golden, and we went up into...
For legal purposes, we probably shouldn't clarify too much.
Yeah, as will become apparent. Right, so we went off into the hills or the mountains or the whatever it was, and Mike found some weird stuff on Google Earth that he wanted to look at, and some abandoned roads and things, and basically we went ADV, we went ADV trespassing. Is that a great way to describe it? I don't know.
It's about right.
We went through this like series of roads, which were of decreasing quality until we finally found this road that said it was private or whatever, but it was just in the middle of nowhere. So we thought, well, whatever, if we get told to turn around, we'll turn around. Right. And wow, it basically just turned into trail. Right. Mm-hmm. So we're on the Buell Firebolt, the Super Hawk, and your heavy touring bike. Basically on trails and like rocky steep trails too.
Mm-hmm.
None of us had any problems though, and I'm willing to bet that I heavy quotes ADV rode my Super Hawk a lot more hardcore than 90% of the Boulder residents who own an adventure bike.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. So we went and we got some an amazing picture with the bikes, but then we're quickly told by a resident. Well, hold on. As we got to near the end of the trail, I did notice basically a giant log with a motion detector on it. And that was our downfall. So it wasn't long after that, this pickup truck comes cruising by and this dude's like, so what are you doing here? Right. And I don't know, basically replace the weird accent with a Colorado mountain accent, and it was the dude from Pet Cemetery that told us that we weren't supposed to be there. And so we're like, yeah, no problem, turn around, whatever. So we go about halfway back down this trail, is a better word than road, and then all of a sudden there's three fuck faces in the middle of the road, like stopping us, telling us we're trespassing. Mike stops, flips open his visor. He's like, yep, you know, we're in the wrong. This dude in this truck already supposed to turn around. We're turning around. You know, we're going back exactly the way we came. That is the best way to get out of here. And this woman just really wanted to just berate us. And big points to Mike for actually pushing her out of the way with his motorcycle. After she told him about 10 times that he wasn't supposed to be here, and he'd said 10 times, yep, we're leaving, he just went, well, okay then, turned his handlebars and just sort of brushed around her and was like, I'll be on my way. And then she felt the need to stop me and settle my hash. I just said like 4 times in a row, that's right, we're leaving. Yeah, that's right. We're leaving. And it just wasn't good enough for her. And she felt the need to yell, get the fuck out of here. Never fucking come back. I don't know. These were people that, I don't know. Basically, my impression of Boulder has sunk to an even deeper level.
Well, these weren't Boulder people.
They were a weird breed. They were very strange. I don't know what was going on with them. Because they didn't seem like hill jacks. I don't know what was up with them. But whatever. But then we went and saw like the weirdest monument I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
Was it called the Cold War Horse? Is that right?
I believe so, yeah.
So, like, what, maybe 15 miles from where we were is where the Cold War horse was? Maybe 20 miles, something like that?
Yeah, thereabouts.
And basically, it's this monument, which is just a scale statue of a horse wearing a hazmat suit with a mask, right? And it's bright red with black boots. And it's all about how this area in Golden basically is covered in radiation and was home to a site which did something with plutonium, made plutonium triggers, right?
They made all the plutonium triggers for, like, the U.S. arsenal.
Right. And basically the company which did it was ridiculously irresponsible, had multiple, like, plutonium fires, and the whole area is basically unsafe to live in, technically. Yet all the land was sold by the EPA to a private contractor. And now there's a bunch of suburban houses there, and no one seems to care, except there's this little statue of a horse in a hazmat suit.
Apparently it's safe, but it's like nobody's allowed to build a basement. And you can't go scuba diving in the reservoir nearby, and it's a little sketchy.
Well, there were also some things about all the prairie dogs dying of bubonic plague and radiation.
It's an interesting combo.
Yeah, I don't know. But it was quite an interesting day's ride, that's for sure. I was really shocked at actually how well we were able to go through that trail on basically the three worst bikes for purpose.
My bike was pretty good with the ground clearance.
The clearance was never an issue for me, but I was picking my route pretty carefully. Who knows? Maybe something did brush against the underside of my bike, but I didn't feel it. There was some mud that the back wheel was getting a little lively on me in some points, but I don't know. We'll post the pictures that we took of the bike, and you can see for yourselves how far the hell out there in the mountains we actually got. Well, we should probably just take a look at that picture and make sure it's suitable first, but I think it should be the banner for the page. All right. So, moving on. Are we ready for best worst bike?
We are.
All right. You're going first?
Yep.
And what have you got?
The worst bike in the world this week is Some Dude's Custom Softail.
Okay. Yeah, so you sent this to me about a week ago, and this thing, everything about this bike is wrong. So we haven't done a Craigslist post ad before, so this is our first one.
And how do we start? It's a little out of the formula, but I feel like this warrants its own worst bike in the world expose.
I don't disagree. So let's start with the listing here. So it's listed as a custom Softail, $9,500 in Lakewood.
Well, let's edit that part out, because this post is still up.
It's public information, right? Okay, so it has what, like 3 miles on it?
Let's get to that later.
Okay.
Now, for $9,500 for a Harley, you would think, oh, maybe this is like a 2008 or a 2010. Maybe it's in not great condition. No, this is a 2004 Harley Davidson Softail, and it's a custom build. This guy claims that he spent $15,000 in parts.
Parts alone.
This is a $17,500 motorcycle in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
He swapped it out for a 240 rear tire. It's basically a car tire.
Yep.
He bored it out to 1,850 cc's.
Right.
On top of that, he went with the open belt drive. He says Softail suspension, but if you actually look at the picture and then you look at a stock Softail,
yes,
That wheel is sitting about 4 inches closer to the bottom of the mudguard.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole part of the frame that looks rigid is what actually moves with the suspension. And it's basically a fake swing arm.
Yeah.
There is nowhere for that wheel to go. It might as well be a rigid frame.
Yes.
Which is ironic because it's the soft tail. He still has the 2004 title. It's good. Now, here's the thing. He's asking $9,500 for it.
Right.
If you go back to 2004, assuming he titled it, paid his taxes on it, paid the dealer fees, paid the MSRP, the $15,000 in parts, the shop time, insurance, and then just sat on it. And let's say you only got 1 year of insurance and only paid 1 year of tax on it.
Right.
1 year of registration.
Which is almost certainly what happened.
This guy has dropped about $50,000 in today's money on this bike.
Right.
He's asking for $9,500 in today's money on this bike.
Yep.
And he has done 4 miles.
4 miles.
Now, if you read the description, he says, you'll need to bring a battery and fuel to run just the way it is. And then he says, lost interest years ago due to life getting in the way. Apparently, life got in the way after 4 miles.
I don't think he ever put the 4 miles on it. I think those 4 miles were put on it as a just it being moved around from the factory and a couple test miles from the custom shop that did the work.
There's a good chance.
I don't think this guy ever rode it. Or if he did, it had 3 miles on it. He got on it with no experience, zero experience. He just paid all this money for this bike that he thought looked fucking cool, man. He went 1 mile. It scared the shit out of him. Because honestly, if this would be a terrifying bike to ride if it was the first thing you ever got on
it. It may be a terrifying bike for an experienced rider.
Exactly. Is there a front brake?
There's a single disc front brake, yeah.
Okay. This is just not something. I do want to mention also that I recognize that it definitely has Shinko tires on it, which is an odd choice after all the other money he spent.
I've also noticed there is an iron cross on the crankcase, which is a little interesting.
Especially for someone who is definitely not a biker. And I also love the detail of the fake bullet hole on the oil reservoir. Because, yeah, he's clearly a bad dude and been in some dangerous situations.
Yeah.
It's interesting also that he placed it on the oil tank. Because, well, if it was a real bullet hole, it would clearly just be leaking oil. So, I don't know what that's all about either. Yeah, every single bit of this, all the controls, everything have been, you know, replaced with really stupid custom parts. This was some guy's idea of a dream bike. Not even an actual dream bike. His idea of a dream bike. And then he realized after 1 year, 1 mile, that riding was not for him. And it's taken him 14 years to come to grips with that.
This bike is kind of like, you know, when you were a kid and you were thinking about, like, eventually I'm going to be an adult and I'm going to have my own house. And you thought, how amazing would it be if I had a refrigerator and microwave in my bedroom?
Yeah.
that's the level of naivete that went into building this bike.
Yeah, I love the ridiculous the ridiculous turn signal side mirror. I think that this side mirror and its placement wouldn't even give you like a great view of your shoulder. This side mirror would give you a view of your forearm or wrist at best, maybe.
Pretty much.
Like, this bike was put together without anyone riding it or realizing what it was going to be like to ride it. Why would you go through all of these things when you haven't even completed mile one?
So, I did do some math.
Uh-huh.
I got some stats for you.
Okay.
Now, normally people think the stats are a little dry, but these are some interesting stats.
Okay, lay it on me.
Since 2004, this bike has done 1,600 feet per year.
Okay.
When you take the total cost of ownership and divide it by the distance traveled,
right,
it cost $2.60 per foot traveled. I looked up some other stats and determined that you could maintain a near fatal dose of meth for a year straight, and you would still have made a less costly financial decision than buying this motorcycle.
Yeah.
I also worked out that if for once a month you went out to a nice hotel downtown,
uh-huh,
racked up $100 bar bill, got a nice room, hired a $300 hooker, split an 8-ball of coke, got her pregnant, and had to pay for a first trimester abortion, you could do that every month for a year. You're still ahead of this guy. I just want you to understand how mind-blowingly awful a decision it was to purchase this bike and how naive it was.
This sort of gets back to our, your cafe racer isn't as cool as you think it is thing, right? This guy spent all this money, but the dude who went and spent $160 to get his full endorsement and then got a Honda Reflex scooter is way more of a legit biker than this guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he only had to spend $2,000.
Right.
And he got a vehicle with amazing practicality. And I bet he did a lot more than 4 miles. He did more than 4 miles taking his test.
Right. So, I mean, here's the thing. This bike really pissed me off when I first saw it. And, you know, there's all the dumb things they've done. But I've seen a lot of dumb bikes. And I couldn't really pin down what it was for a while. And after a while, I figured it out.
Uh-huh.
This is the bike that is killing American motorcycle culture. This bike is $50,000 down the hole. No riding experience attained. No adventures. No fun. You can't even credit this guy with riding it down to the bar a block away once a month and hanging out with his riding buddies.
Like, right.
There's 4 miles. What kind of sustainable business or consumption can you do in 4 miles?
I mean, unless his bar is literally next door.
Right. So Harley got its cut. The parts supplier got their cut.
S&S got their cut.
The shop that fitted it all got their cut.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to guess that he's still got the original battery in there since he's asking you to bring a battery down.
Right.
And I imagine those are the original tires. He probably hasn't changed the oil. So he's not buying tires. He's not replacing batteries. He's not changing oil. He's not buying gas for it. And as I said, you can't even credit him with going down to the local biker bar and buying a beer.
You know what? I bet there's 14-year-old gas in it.
There's a very good chance.
I bet this thing won't start. I bet there's just jelly inside that gas tank.
I think there's a very good chance. But he doesn't even know that because he can't even get it to start, which is why he's asking you to bring a battery down.
Right.
Now, here's the thing. This man has converted nobody into riding. Mm-hmm. He didn't ride with any of his friends. Maybe in the first year of ownership and up until the end of the winter, he'd have friends around for a barbecue and say, oh, come check this out in the garage.
Yeah.
And show them their bike, show them his bike.
I bet he did that for at least 4 years after he did that 1 mile.
And then after a certain point, it became a point of shame.
Yes.
And it lived under a tarp in the corner of the garage, and he steered people away from it because he's shown it to all of his friends. He's shown it to his family. They've never seen him ride it. I'm going to bet that he doesn't actually have his motorcycle license.
There's no way. I think, yeah, he showed it to everyone for years because he thought, well, at some point, you know, maybe I'll take that time and I'll take that course after that 1 mile scared the hell out of him. I'm wondering also, because $15,000 in parts alone sounds a bit much, even, you know, for the S&S and the bore out and all that other stuff. I'm wondering if he rode it that 1 mile and crashed it. And then it was a new tank. It was some more paint. It was, you know, all that stuff, new bar ends and exhaust and everything. And that's where half of the parts money comes from in this equation.
Ooh, interesting.
And that's why it's still only got 4 miles. He rode it 1 mile, crashed it really quickly, had it all fixed, and it's just been sitting there, and he hasn't had the guts to get back on it.
I think there's a very good chance of that. I mean, you also, if you look at it, there's lots of parts on this bike he never zooms in on. You do have a very limited look. Like, you don't have a complete look over the whole bike like you normally do.
If you go back to that shot of it from the rear fender does look a little off, too. Or is that maybe just the way the picture is? It's hard to say. But that rear fender may be bent just slightly.
I don't know. I think it's just the light.
It could be.
But, you know, this guy's probably spent about $50,000 in today's money. But if you, as somebody who rides, if you ride regularly and you convert two people into riding motorcycles and they do nothing but buy $1,000 to $2,000 used bikes for the rest of their lives, but they're lifelong riders, you've done more to stimulate the motorcycle, the overall motorcycle economy than this guy has.
Yeah. Yeah, because, well, I don't know. He hasn't disclosed how much he spent on bitchin' gear. Because you know this douchebag bought like a $30 do-rag, right? You know he bought a $200 pair of sunglasses. You know he bought a $600 jacket, which provides no safety. Got a $50 pair of fingerless gloves. He got a $280 pair of bitchin' biker boots with the, you know, he got,
I don't know, I don't,
a new
I
set
don't
of
think,
Levi's, and
I don't think this guy is aware that eye protection is a legal requirement in Colorado.
Yeah, but this guy needed to have this bike that had this certain image, so he needed all the quote biker gear to wear, right? Because he couldn't just roll up on this to a bar. He's got to be able to walk into the bar, you know, doing all the cosplay as well, right?
That it's true.
It's true. Yeah, this guy probably spent another $1,000 in just weird biker shit to wear.
Where on the Harley-Davidson escalation scale does this guy fit? Because you know he had a friend who got a Sportster. And you know he's got another friend who one-upped him with a Road King. And you know he's got another friend who tried to one-up him with the Ultra Classic. Now, did this guy come in before the Ultra Classic? Or is he an intermediary between the Ultra Classic and the Freewheeler?
That's what I'm thinking. Right. He needed to up it, and he thought he could be more authentic than those guys who bought bikes off the showroom floor. So he went back in his very, very confused mind and was reminded of watching Easy Rider. But he also realized, well, I kind of liked Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man, too. And he's like, but, you know, that Sons of Anarchy show, well, no, 2004 is pre-Sons of Anarchy, but it was a very, very much of that sort of thing he was thinking of. And he's like, no, man, I got to be like a real biker.
At some point, they were offering the Screaming Eagle package to him. And he said, well, that's all well and good, but that's not going to be enough. And right. A Harley Davidson salesperson jizzed his pants on the spot.
I'm surprised it still has turn signals.
I'm surprised it has a brake light.
Yeah. It is a monument to just, I have no idea. It's a monument to, I have no idea what I'm doing.
I just realized it's technically not even street legal.
Why is that?
It doesn't have a reflector on it.
Oh, no, it doesn't. It doesn't have a license plate light either.
Well, that's true, but the license plate is something that you get when you register it. This guy...
Yeah, this bike was never even registered.
Yeah.
So he must have taken this out and thought, well, I'll just go up and down the street. And then he crashed it. And that's really where the shame comes from. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's adding up.
I bet if we went back into the Wayback Machine, we could find some early listings of this bike for like $25,000.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. This has been going down and down and down in price. Because no one wants this kind of bike anymore. It's not a bagger. It's not practical. It's going to be a maintenance nightmare.
I feel like Harley Davidson riders are learning that their bikes are not worth what they invested into them one rider at a time.
Yeah, one rider at a time. That's exactly it.
Because I feel like there's this moment of shame when they realize what my 2011 Road King with all chromed out with 40,000 miles on it isn't still worth $21,000.
Right.
And it's this moment of shame. And I feel like they just can't actually tell their friends what they sold their bikes for.
Yeah, yeah.
But here's the worst thing about this bike. Okay. The absolute worst thing. Somebody is going to see this bike and think, oh my God, this is amazing. They'll pay him the they'll pay him the full $9,500.
Yeah.
Realize that it's a complete unrideable mess. Right. For the overpaid, and now it's their problem. And it's going to stop that person from becoming a lifelong rider. This is a cursed monkey paw.
It is. And you know, maybe like the shop did shitty work and he crashed it because like the front brake isn't set up right or something. Like, who knows? It's never been ridden. It's never been tested. Like, we don't even know that this bike really runs. It says 4 miles, but is that from before the engine was bored out? Like, I don't know.
Is that just him rolling it in and out of his garage with a mechanical odometer?
Right.
Like, who knows?
I wouldn't give him $1,500 for it. It's hot garbage. Good luck to you, buddy. I hope you get your money for it, but not from us or anyone we know. All right. We ready to move on to best bike in the world?
I think so.
All right. And now the best bike in the world is the 1988 to 2006 Kawasaki GPZ250R, otherwise known as the EX250 or just the Ninja 250.
Yes.
This thing is magical. The poor cousin, often left out of the Ninja family, but in many ways, the most legitimate member of the Ninja family. Now, I'm specifically talking about what's called the third generation Ninja 250, right? And there's a bunch of weird ones from the beginning, some Japan-only models, but the 88 to 2006 is really just the best one and was basically completely unchanged for that entire run of the model. maybe some minor adjustments in the plastics and the fairings, but largely no change in that even. No change in the engine, really. I think by this point in the model, they'd gone down from the 32 millimeter carburetors to the 30. That this is when they sort of, from the earlier years, dialed it in and made it the absolute rock solid, reliable little screamer that it is, right? The specs on this bike, whilst they don't seem to move mountains, are really actually crazy impressive. So it makes 18 foot-pounds of torque, but let's compare it to maybe the next best-selling 250, the Rebel 250, which makes 11 foot-pounds of torque. This thing makes...
18 foot-pounds of torque is more than an SR 400.
Exactly. This thing makes 36 horsepower. Compare that to the 24 that the Honda Rebel gets. This thing weighs 305 pounds dry. Compare that to like the 380 that the Rebel weighs. This thing has a top speed, depending on how light you are and how and your ability and how much you can tuck in aerodynamics, somewhere that could be as much as 105 miles per hour. You can break 100 miles an hour on this little 250. These things will get anywhere from as poor as 45 miles per gallon to as good as 75 highway cruising. There's no shortage of people who have done cross-country trips on these, round-the-world trips and international trips across Europe and Asia and North America. You can do very limited but still wheelies on this. It's a ninja. It looks like a proper sport bike, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone remarks now how like the 300s and the 400s look like legitimate sport bikes. This one did back in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no reason to ever be embarrassed sitting on one of these. They're a little small, but not really. Especially when you think about how much 600s have shrunk down now, right? This is really about that size and stature.
Well, this bike is still bigger than a CBR 500R, just in terms of volume.
Maybe. But I think it's a really gorgeous looking bike too. And it's one of those bikes where depending on what colors you get on it really changes the dynamic and the look of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it radically changes it.
But it's also a very distinctive look. There's no mistaking this bike for any other bike, right? I mean, even the Rebel 250, which is a very distinct looking bike, you could sort of be like, what is that from a distance? If you don't know what you're looking at, right? You can kind of go like, oh, it's some guy go by on a Sportster if you only got a glimpse or whatever. The Ninja 250, you just know exactly what it is right away. But none of those impressive things about this bike are why it's the best bike in the world. The reason it's the best bike in the world this week is a lot more the reason that the KLR 650 was the best bike in the world, a month ago or whatever. It's because you can find one of these on any Craigslist anywhere for $800 to $1,500 in decent running shape with nothing wrong with it. And there's nothing to this bike. This is the bike that you can buy and just clean the carbs and go. They are absolutely bulletproof. And it's crazy that they're bulletproof because they wring so much power out of that little 250. What do you think the red line is on this?
Okay, so it came after. So this is, what, 3 years after the GPZ 900R. They're going to go for similar theming. I'm going to guess that it's... I'm going to go for 9,500.
14,000 RPM.
What?
Yeah.
It's a twin.
Yeah. That's how it gets 12 more horsepower than a Honda Rebel.
Is it like a 4-to-1 bore and stroke?
I don't remember what the bore and stroke is. Also, what do you think the compression is on this?
Well, now that you've told me that, I'm going to guess it's something stupid like 12.5.
12.4.
Oh, there you go.
So this is a 250 that needs mid-grade fuel. you will get engine knock if you put 85 in this. So this is a serious sport bike, actually, just in that 250 class. This is the 390 Duke of its time. This is the most serious little bike in its class, but it's so much more than that. Because also, how large do you think the fuel tank is?
It's going to be like 4 gallons.
5.
What?
If you fill this with a full tank of gas and hit the highway, you will give up before it runs out of gas, right? Average fuel economy of 55 to 60 miles per gallon times 5, right? You're going to be like, geez, I've been riding a hot minute. Like we're coming up on 300 miles. I need to put a foot down. Right?
Wow. I had no idea.
This thing is amazing. And also, like the KLR 650, which is the highest contender in this category, this comes in at a hot second place for most likely to have improvised luggage. I have seen a lot of people take Harbor Freight toolboxes to the sides of these things for touring luggage and just do it. This is a bike for all people, because you can get a really cool old mint one and you can, you know, get new plastics for it, whatever. And you can have this sort of classic-ish, like really clean little thing. Or you could just get a shitbox one and just drill holes in the fairings and put your improvised luggage on it and take it to class if you're a broke student. Or you can, you know, get your full body leathers and everything and you can take it to the track and you can sort of race it against other weird 250 things and be competitive or win. You can do so much with it. I can't think with being restricted to just being on the road. I can't think of another bike you can do so many things with for $1,200.
Yeah, there's really not a lot.
And in any town, on any Craigslist, you will find one. Just right now, you'll find a 250 Ninja, and there'll be a whole story about someone who loved the hell out of it and rode it all over the place. This is, you know, a bike for everyone. And what no one also ever brings up is that for the entire run of this bike, it was Kawasaki's best-selling bike.
Now, that's not a surprise to me.
But no one ever talks about this. It's the Ninja that's always left out of the Ninja Club. Mm-hmm. People talk about the GPZ 900s and the ZX7s and the ZX10s and the, you know, the ZX14s, all that stuff. But, you know, they talk about the Legend, the ZX1100 or ZZR1100 and all that stuff. But rarely is the 250 Ninja celebrated as really the biggest moneymaker, which is odd, too, because what do you think this bike was brand new?
In 88?
Yeah.
I'm going to guess like 2200.
Actually, I don't know the 88 price. It was something like that. But in 2006, it was like $4,000.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so that would have been like, if you work down to inflation, so it would have been like $3,000 or so in 88.
Right.
If you took that same price.
Right. So for the price, I mean, what does everything that this does? What has excellent fuel economy? What has amazing range? What will break 100 miles an hour? What has leading performance in its class? What has classic styling and heritage behind its name and comes in at that price that does everything that this bike does? Nothing. Nothing comes close to being such a bike for the people.
You know what's really sad?
What's that?
That right after this bike was discontinued, that was the ZZR 250 they used in Kill Bill Volume 1.
Yeah, if you think, oh, Ninja 250, that's not very cool. This is the bike from Kill Bill. There you go. Sub-zero cool. There, that's all you need to know. And I don't know if you got something else to add. Just the numbers speak for themselves on this one.
I think it's pretty straightforward. There's not a lift, not a lot to not a lot to fight back on.
There we go. GPZ, GPX, ZX, EX, ZZR. 250, R, whatever. Kawasaki Ninja 250. Best bike in the world. Okay, and we're back. And now I think you wanted to talk about actually some gripes you've got about the podcast bike, the Norge.
So it's really one gripe that we're going to roll into a few different experiences.
Okay.
So the first one is that it runs on 1060 oil.
Yeah.
Which is a little ridiculous. Now, I understand that when Norge, or when Moto Guzzi first released this bike, it was kind of an early foray into four valve per cylinder engines.
Right.
And they had to find a way to really make it work and be reliable and long lasting. So they had to put a second oil pump in it and just bukkake the valves just in oil all the time. And they had to make all these compromises to really make their, you know, what really is their pedigree, which is transverse air-cooled twins, work in the modern era. And I also realize that it's a $16,000 motorcycle brand new.
Right.
And maybe this is just, you know, maybe this is me just being pedantic because I basically bought the equivalent of a 30-year-old non-collectible supercar.
Right.
So that I can somewhat forgive. But here's the thing. So actually, let me just backtrack a little bit. While I was down at COTA, I did drop the Norge.
Yeah.
So it was dark, and I basically was trying to pull it up onto some gravel, and went a little too close to our gazebo at the campsite, caught my leg, and dumped it at about 2 miles an hour.
Oh, I didn't realize you were moving. Okay.
Yeah. My leg just caught, like, the guide wire on the gazebo, and it was an extremely slow and dramatic fall.
Gotcha.
So I picked it up, put it back over, and it was like, okay. Turn signal popped off, just epoxied and put that back on. There's some scratches on the paint. It's like, okay, this is, like, maybe $50 to fix.
Right.
So we get back to Denver, you know, we gorilla tape the turn signal back on to get back to Denver. Yeah. And, you know, scratches aren't too bad on the fairing. So I look online. It's impossible to find a paint code for this thing. Eventually I find it on like some like obscure Moto Guzzi forum. I find the American and the European paint code for it, which also, by the way, why do we have two different paint code systems for America and Europe? I understand metric and imperial. Okay, we have to retool entire factories. It's just not worth the cost. I understand driving on the left side of the road and the right side of the road. It's utter chaos to switch that. I understand, you know, miles and kilometers. It's just something that's hardwired into people's brains at this point. But paint codes seem like a very, very achievable goal to unify. I don't really understand that. Also, when I put the paint codes into all of the different like online automotive sites, none of them returned anything. Apparently, you can't just give somebody a paint code. At least as far as I can tell, you can't actually just give somebody a paint code and request some paint for that paint code. It's really just a way for people to identify what it is and find it from the original manufacturer, from what I can tell. Because it was impossible. I've been searching for days and can't find anything. Eventually, I dig into another forum and find out that it's OEM Ferrari Rosso Corsa paint.
Which is cool.
It is very cool. On the other hand,
also when you say Ferrari Rosso, I just hear cash registers chinging up in the background. Like, how yes. much more expensive is this paint than it really should be?
So I was like, well, what can I do here? So I actually went down to Erica Motorsports,
mm-hmm.
who are basically the Piaggio dealer
right.
in Denver. And when I asked the guy, hey, can you just find me some of this paint for a red 08 Norge? He was like, I have never, ever seen a single paint touch-up kit from Piaggio for any bike.
Oh, really?
At all. So now I'm at the point where I've basically done the same thing I did with the clutch pressure pin.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like paying $40 online and rolling the dice, hoping I get the right part from some guy in Europe selling a pot of Rosso Corsa paint.
Right.
And I'm just hoping it works. And I understand all these problems are all my own fault.
Right.
But when the CV1000 tipped over, it was a 33-year-old bike at the time, and I could still go to a myriad of sites and buy an OEM turn signal for that bike.
Right.
So why can't I do the same thing for a 10-year-old Moto Guzzi? Like, what's going on? Especially when you look at, like,
there's only one answer. Because he's Italian. Right?
Right. So everything about the bike, the experience,
you can
the
ride, try very odd to find the paint, but it's not really going to work out well for you. Try very odd as much as you want, but it's not, yeah. It's
right. But that's the thing. It's like, you know, Moto Guzzi is like 0.3%, probably less, of motorcycle sales in the U.S.,
oh, yeah.
And it's like, and they're trying, and they're doing a lot to kind of move in and build a bigger brand and sell more bikes here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think if anyone I knew who was not, you know, who wasn't really savvy as a mechanic or, you know, doing their own maintenance
mm-hmm.
and really savvy about hunting parts down on eBay or looking up and finding the original manufacturer and not the OEM part, and they've been riding for like a year, or they were looking to get a brand new bike as their first bike, I don't think I could recommend a Moto Guzzi at this point.
Well, do you think you would have all of these problems if it was a V7 or like a V7 stone?
Well, maybe not, but it's only 10 years old.
That's true, but the V7
9 years
is
from now,
currently being sold and sitting in dealerships.
9 years from now, an EBR will have better factory support than like a Stelvio bot today by these standards. Like, think about that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
You should your level of service and support for your vehicles should exceed a company that no longer exists. I don't think that's a high bar to set.
Okay, this is true. This is true. Yeah, because it's true. Like, if you, it's not just because it's Italian. That was a bit unfair. Because if you do have a Ducati, there's support all over the place. It's expensive, but it is there. I mean, yeah, but, you know, you can get all this stuff if you're in Europe. So it's really just, it's the problem you run into if you've got a Royal Enfield and you've got to order all this crazy crap from India. And, you know, you can get off whatever eBay store you want. It can say it's based in Chicago, but really this shit's got to get shipped from some crazy place in India. And it's going to arrive anywhere between the 6 weeks and when the earth falls into the sun. And you don't know exactly what's showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Like when Steve needed that new valve adjustment, that new valve cover for his Bullet 500, I found one for him and ordered it. And the one that showed up said, Royals Enfield. Like Royal Enfield was misspelled on it.
Excellent.
And yeah, so you're running into an issue like that. But I mean, overall, the bike has still been ridiculously reliable. But I guess what you're running into is what's going to happen if something goes wrong with like the valves. What's going to happen then? What's that support? What are you going to be able to find to get it fixed or something on that level? Right.
Right.
And that's part of the reason why you got it so cheap, you know. And if you just think, well, if I just run it until it dies because of the price you got it for, you're still well ahead of the game. Right.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So I don't know. Because 2006, I don't think they'd put out the new V7s by then, had they?
This is an 08.
An 08? Well, even 2008, though. I don't remember seeing any new V7s around in the States until maybe about like 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe if you've got a newer generation of bike, the support level's different. We'll have to investigate that. But it is still...
We need to find somebody with a V7 and then... You know what we need to do? We need to like cold call Erico, from somebody else's phone or something, and just be like, "Yeah, I crashed my V7. I need a new exhaust." And be like, "Yeah, let's just pretend and try and find like turn levers and clutch pins and turn signals from Erico for a V7 and see what it comes out as."
Yeah.
Maybe the support is better for the latest generation.
I'm willing to bet that it is, because they are making a concerted effort to, like you said, increase their sales here, because they're great bikes and they're not a bad value for what they are. And, you know, when we talked about, you know, what all the manufacturers brought down to Coda to show off, right? While Moto Guzzi's line of bikes is very small compared to other manufacturers, they still brought basically everything,
mm-hmm.
which is really just three different platforms at this point.
Well, they didn't bring a Stelvio.
That's true. They didn't have the Stelvio, which is odd because the big adventure bikes or sport tours are such a big market now with old guys that buy new bikes.
It is really in vogue right now. So it's very strange that they didn't bring it down.
But save the Stelvio and the... Did they have a Grizzo there? No, there wasn't a Grizzo.
There wasn't a Grizzo, no.
No. But they had like, what, 4 or 5 different flavors of V7? They had the V9, the Roamer, and the Bobber. Not sure what makes the V9 Bobber a Bobber. Wait, no. I just remembered. We did find out.
There was a quarter inch taken off the back of the seat.
Yeah, that's the part that was bobbed. But they had like every version of the California. They had the MGX 21 Flying Fortress.
Count Dracula's motorcycle.
Right, they had the California, the El Dorado, and then the other weird named one. Which is like the stepped down version from the Flying Fortress. But they're all really just the California.
Yeah.
They had all that stuff there. And, you know, and when, you know, like, let's say, you know, Suzuki just brought Gixxers and that was it. And Bergmans.
They did bring a,
Well, actually, they brought a lot of bikes you could test ride, but you couldn't actually see as a show bike, which was interesting.
They did bring down a V-Strom as well. Did they had?
Only the 1000, though. I don't think they brought the 650, which was odd as well.
Which somehow, what was it? Didn't they have like a misprint on the sticker saying it was like 900 pounds or something?
Yeah, that's true. Like, a lot of the Moto Guzzi cards had mistakes all over them. It's very, very Italian for them to just be like, yeah, who cares? It's a Guzzi, you know.
I was very disappointed by Kawasaki just not showing up.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really disappointing. I mean, I know they don't race, but Neither does Moto Guzzi in GP. So, come on. Maybe Kawasaki's not that concerned with the American market, but like I feel like they are. Like, that's really where they live. It's one of their bigger markets. I don't think Kawasaki sells that many small bikes in Asia as compared to these other manufacturers, or that many small bikes in Europe compared to these other manufacturers. Like,
and they Honda really and should be everywhere, since, you know, they are now kind of, when you look at all the equivalent bikes for all of the big four, Kawasaki's kind of the cost king right now.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, the Z900, like, all, if you're looking to buy a new bike and you don't care for a fairing, all roads lead to the Z900. There's no reason to buy anything over the Z900. It costs less than just about everything else, over 650 cc's. And even the things that it costs more than, which isn't much for what you're getting, it's like double the value in terms of the power and all the features and all of that.
Not just that, but when you compare class to class, the Ninja 650, the Ninja 400, the Versus 650, the Versus 300, like everything in their lineup is cheaper.
Yeah. And quite often just outperforms on top of it. It's nuts. So, I don't know. Get your shit together, Kawasaki, and try to sell us some shit. Because they have, like, some legendary bikes that no one really talks about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like the Ninja 250 or, you know, whatever. Okay. So, I don't know. It's interesting that there isn't that support for the Guzzi again, getting back to this. What do you foresee going really wrong? I mean, the oil thing is the main thing right now. Because looking it up, it seems that about the average going rate for one quart of 10W60 is $16 plus shipping. Because there's no storefront where you can just buy 1060 oil.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. I'm willing to absorb that cost, especially when it has like a 6,000 mile service interval. Like,
yeah.
That's fine. The main thing is like, if I ever drop that bike or somebody knocks it over and a fairing cracks,
like, you just gotta live with it.
I've gotta live with it, or I've basically just gotta push it into a ditch and move on with my life. Like, there's no recovering from that. And I don't think that bike is going to work too well without a fairing, because it is fairly top heavy. It's not air. When you look at that engine through the fairing, it's not going to be aerodynamic and work very well as a naked bike. I think if you took those fairings off, that bike would be absolutely terrifying to ride at 75 miles an hour.
Possibly.
Just the whole package and how it works together, it just wouldn't work. So that is kind of the risk that I'm running right now, is it may just, well, this may actually turn out to be a blessing in disguise.
Uh-huh.
Because I do have collision and comprehensive insurance on it.
Oh, yeah.
So, if I just crack the fairing and say, fairing's cracked, and they're going to look and they're going to try and source a part, and they're going to say, it's a write-off. New fairing for this bike is $8,000. It's like, look, here's $7,000.
Yeah.
It's written off.
Then you can just go find another one on Craigslist.
Maybe. Well, based on what they charged for insurance, which was like $30 a month, as opposed to like the $17 for the W650.
Right.
It may be valued significantly higher still. It may be a blessing in that it's actually retail valued significantly higher than what I paid for it.
Right.
So maybe that's not really a huge danger. I mean, it probably will be like...
It's a danger in you actually losing that particular bike. But in terms of being out a huge amount of money, maybe they were just complete idiots to insure it for you.
Well, it depends what they value it for. When, if that ever does happen. I don't know what the insurance company will think it's worth. I know the Jag was worth, they paid out on the Jag, without me even negotiating, significantly more than I expected.
Yeah. Okay, so.
I almost feel like it would be more dangerous if I crashed the W650, and it, or if it got hit or knocked over and it got written off. I feel like I wouldn't, I would feel like I would get more money for the Moto Guzzi than it's worth, and have to fight to get what the W650 is worth.
Right, because they're not clued in. It takes so long for them to clue in to what's worth more.
Right.
Because of its, yeah, if it's an unusual bike or a collector thing or becoming a collector thing. Yeah. Okay. So basically, no, go ahead and buy a Moto Guzzi. Just make sure you have full coverage.
Yeah.
Is what we're saying. It's worth the extra few bucks a month because you could make out like a bandit.
We'll find out.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll find out. Yeah. Okay. So, we also wanted to talk about racetracks and not those just in Austin, Texas. Those around here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or more specifically, the lack of them around here. Now, there is a track somewhere around the airport here, and I can't remember what it's called. And it's small, and it sprang up because another track disappeared before it.
It's called IMI.
No, there's another one.
Another one?
Yeah, there is.
Mm.
But there's IMI as well, but that's just a short, like, 1 mile little thing. And you can't really take anything on that track more than, like, a 250 or a 300. It's just not that big. It's a go-kart track. It's not a real. But there is one, like, real track, but it's not a spectator track. It's not an event sort of track. It's not something that can host a big event. It's not a world-class facility, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got some theories on why we need that kind of track in this part of the country.
Oh, yes. Okay, so here's the thing. We used to have the Indianapolis Speedway. We used to have...
Well, we still do have the Indianapolis Speedway.
Okay, let me back up.
You'll find there's a certain event happening there at the end of this month. Kind of a big one.
Let me correct. So, we, you know, for MotoGP,
uh-huh.
We used to have... The circuit used to be... Circuit of the Americas is race two. We used to then go to Laguna Seca and then go to the Indianapolis Speedway.
I don't think all three of them ever existed on the schedule at once. There were
They did years, in 2013.
All three of them?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. Now, there's also some tracks in Canada.
I don't remember that.
There also are some decent tracks in Canada, but they're kind of not really usable around April.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. That was kind of, I think they did Jerez in between and then they would come back for Laguna Seca and the Indy 500 and the Speedway later.
I still don't think they did all three in 1 year. I think there were a couple years where Laguna Seca and Indianapolis both existed on the schedule and years where COTA and Indianapolis existed on the schedule, but never all three.
I believe they did in 2013.
Just that 1 year?
It might have just been that 1 year. Because they dropped Laguna Seca pretty early on because they couldn't bring Moto 2 and Moto 3 because the facilities are too small.
Yeah, the facilities are out of date. And there's all sorts of like sound regulation around the area now. The racetrack is dying, which is super sad. But whatever.
It was also a ridiculously short track. And while your average MotoGP race is like 20 to 24 laps... This track was like 38 laps.
Yeah. But the corkscrew. The corkscrew. It's such
an iconic thing. But so anyway, to get to the point I'm trying to make here.
Uh-huh.
I think Denver needs a world-class circuit. I'm going to lay the case out for you.
Okay.
First of all, we don't really have a lot of talent in road racing right now, but we do have a lot of talent kind of all around in motocross.
Right.
Which is super popular in Denver.
Yes.
And we also do have a lot of people who are really in love with street, with proper track racing.
Yeah. Club racing and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, COTA's proven that. COTA's basically sold out all of their grandstands last year or this year. And
yeah.
Most of them last year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And people came from thousands of miles to go see it in Austin, which logistically is a nightmare.
Yes.
Now, you look at Denver. We could build a world-class circuit out east past the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, we also have one of the largest, if not the largest airport in the U.S. that can that is absolutely up to task.
Yes.
To handle that kind of traffic. We can build new business and we can build new businesses. We can reuse the track way more than we would ever use, say, an Olympic park.
Yeah.
You know, there's all sorts of business that could sprout up around that. I'm sure there's some farmer who would be willing to part with his field for a boatload of cash somewhere out there, maybe along 70, maybe a little further north. There's plenty of cheap land out there because there's not a lot really going on out there.
It's also the only part of the state that's flat.
There's that. There's loads to do in Denver. It's kind of a unique place. It's something where year-round, when there's not a race going on, it's somewhere that you can start doing, you know, when there's not a when you're not doing MotoGP or Formula One, you can bring in AMA, you can bring in World Superbike, you can bring all sorts of stock car racing. You can just have a shitload of track days and start converting some of our world-class motocross talent into street racing talent.
I want to get back to the geographics and where it's actually a flat spot where you could build a racetrack. In the geography of it, it makes so much sense because it's the center of the country. How often do these race teams have to go from California to, like, you know, Road America in Atlanta, or in back and forth, you know, Talladega, and then go back to Willow Springs and go to Laguna Seca and then go to Indianapolis, right? It's on the way. The semi trucks are already going down I-70, right?
Right.
So it makes perfect sense. It's way easier to get to, not just for fans, for the teams. They're going right by it already.
Right.
They're going from California to Indianapolis to Georgia to Florida to wherever. You're taking I-70.
Right. Now, here's the other thing. Every track kind of has its own little flavor and its own little quirks.
Mm-hmm.
Without even building the track, I can already tell you what it is.
Elevation.
Yeah. You're in the Mile High City racing naturally aspirated sport cars and sport bikes.
Yeah.
So you've already got that. Maybe you could have an uphill corkscrew and call it the Pikes Peak corkscrew, or, you know, you've got all sorts of things you can fit in there. So world-class track, that'll last, that'll be durable, that you've got on the way for all sorts of local, you know, for national level competition, somewhere that you can, that it's close by, that you can convert motocross talent into road racing talent, brings a boatload of business into Denver, can be built on cheap land, we've got the infrastructure to support it. Like, it all just fits together. It's perfect.
Not only that, 300 days of sunshine here. There's, like, it would just never happen that races are rained out.
Right. So now imagine if we went back out to MotoGP. You do an early race at Phillip Island. You then go to Thailand. You know, somewhere in there you've got Lasail. Then you've got Argentina. You push COTA back 2 to 4 weeks. Then you've got Denver. Then you could do Indianapolis. And at that point, you've pushed the schedule back enough. You could also just pick a track in Canada.
No, no, I've got it. I've got it. Tell everyone in Qatar to go fuck themselves.
That would be excellent, too.
And you start the season in Denver. And then they just go down to Argentina and then come back to COTA, right?
Considering that I rode back through snow and rain 2 days after COTA ended, I don't know if you could start the season.
Okay,
start, that's a bit of a roll of the dice.
Maybe start the season at COTA, go down to Argentina, and then come back up to Denver or whatever. There's a way to do
it. I think you start in Phillip Island. I think that makes the most sense.
It could. Is the weather that good in Australia at that time? I guess very end of their summer.
World Superbike did Phillip Island, what, 2 weeks before LoSalle?
Yeah. Okay. But, I mean, not just for motorcycle racing in general. We should have this racetrack for, you know, because it can't just be, you can't have a track for just one event unless it's the Indy 500, right?
Well, here's the other thing. You know, there are so many Americans that are getting into MotoGP and World Superbike. And right now, the only American rider we have in MotoGP is in Moto2. His name is Joe Roberts, and he's on a Moto2 team that nobody can name, that nobody recognizes.
Right.
And it's ridiculous that we have this much support for it, that we have this much motorcycle talent in America, and we're not getting up into the absolute premier class of motorsport racing, because there's nothing driving it towards that. I feel like a centrally located track that's around all of this motocross talent that could start moving people towards it would make a huge difference.
You know, I just thought of something. There seems to be sort of a lack of national pride right now, and I think that has something to do with it as well. You know, I remember late 80s, early 90s, it was all still very much USA number one, right? We're number one in everything, right? And, you know, we'd go to the Olympics and just storm, right? And, yeah, I mean, the U.S. still does in the Olympics, but that's about it. But it used to be this point of pride. It'd be like, you'd name anything, it's like USA number one, right? And if you think about it, too, in motorcycle racing in that era, you know, Schwantz and Wayne Rainey and all those guys, the United States was very prominent in racing worldwide. And I think it was an extension of that USA number one, right? It didn't matter what it was on the world stage. The USA had to show up, right?
Yeah.
And that really doesn't exist anymore. And there isn't sort of a national pride in supporting the American in whatever sports just because. Because the United States has, in general, some great racetracks, right? I mean, Road Atlanta, Road America, you know, COTA, Laguna Seca, the Indianapolis Speedway. I mean, these are all just amazing tracks, really. I mean, the Laguna Seca facilities are just completely inadequate anymore. But outside of that, you know, these are just amazing tracks, right? Talladega, right? There are, like, the idea of building a track in Denver to try to drum up more talent, I don't think is one that holds quite enough water, because we already have all of these amazing tracks where people can go and do these things and attract international events, right? You know, even like Sebring and places like that, you know, and these big 8 hour and 12 hour and 24 hour races. Actually, is Sebring a 24? They do a 12 and they do an 8.
I don't know.
Or at least they used to. Do they even do that anymore? I don't know. It's tough to say. But a track in Denver would be fantastic, because like you said, you can get NASCAR in there. You can get Formula One in there. You can get GP in there. World Superbike, AMA racing of all kinds. I mean, I'm sure you could do like autocross stuff and World Rallycross.
I'm sure you would have space left over to get a flat track in there.
Exactly. The reason Denver, I think, needs this racetrack is because of where it's located, right in the middle of the country, and everyone's driving through already. So why not? You know, I know Colorado is seen as this very sort of like outdoorsy sports kind of place, climbing, kayaking, and all that sort of stuff. But people are just kind of just into doing anything outside. And I don't know, I think that even still extends to just going and seeing a race. Like, honestly, there's so many people ride here, you know, like I just, the last few weeks have just been just, I've seen bikes just exploding out of every garage. And I know that happens every spring, but I've noticed it more this year. And last year I noticed it more than the year before. I really don't believe that riding is becoming less popular. I think it's becoming more popular. People are just a little bit more financially responsible and they're not buying new bikes like they used to. But that means the supply of used bikes is going to run short eventually and everyone will be forced to buy new bikes again.
I did see some interesting stats that somebody posted a while ago that showed if you don't look at new models sold and you just look at motorcycle registrations by year, you can follow it up from the 90s on a very gradual increase, and then a massive spike around 2004 that went way, way up, and then takes a nosedive in 2008 and 2009.
Right.
And it's just, it's really low for a while. And then ever since about 2013, it's just been gradually picking back up where it left off in 2003.
Okay.
Like, it's like once you take that all that noise out of the middle of it, right before and after the recession, it is actually just kind of continuing where it was. So I don't think that the motorcycle culture has gone anywhere. I think a lot of financial decisions around it have changed. But I think there is the same steady increase in number of riders. I don't know if it's increased the same proportion to the population, but it's still grow. The raw numbers are still growing.
Yeah. And yeah, again, like just millennials just are way less willing to take out $30,000 in debt for a Harley. They're not even really sure they want that much.
Right.
And there's definitely not as much pressure to be all like America on your bike anymore. So they're looking at other options and they're looking at used stuff. I'm completely over the panic of new bike sales. It's just not even a real thing to me anymore, which is weird, but that's just sort of my opinion now.
Well, again, let's assume that the motorcycle market completely implodes. You know, it doesn't take a lot of mechanical skill to just Mad Max a motorcycle together. Hell, Brazil did it.
Yeah.
With a VW motor. It's impossible to get rid of motorcycles. They're like cockroaches.
Exactly. Like,
how hard could it be?
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, if enough people, you know, don't buy new bikes long enough, right? You know, the American market, we know, is not what sustains these manufacturers at all, right?
Right.
It's just their showroom to the rest of the world, right?
Yeah.
So all they have to do is be selling some and be the cool bike here, right? So, you know, except for maybe Harley Davidson, whose sales are based so much on the American market, right? But, you know, Harley acts like they're so big, but Honda could buy and sell them 10 times over. Like, they aren't shit compared to Honda. Like, not even close. So,
Honda probably makes more in CBR 500R sales worldwide than Harley's entire annual revenue.
Maybe not on the Honda CBR 500R, but I would say if you put all of their bikes 250 cc's and smaller together, it's larger than everything Harley makes above 883 cc's.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, I'm not convinced that this is like a big problem, and I think that everyone's sort of easing into bikes more responsibly than they did in the 80s and 90s and even the early 2000s, when the culture was just like, yeah, like your house will only ever be worth more. Debt's not bad. Debt can be good. Like, you know, there's a lot of weird thinking at the time, right? Like, why would you pay for this now? You know, take out a loan. It's fine. Interest rates are nothing. Go for
it. It's okay. Yeah. Your house will increase beyond the rate of inflation forever.
Yeah.
That trend will never change. It's like, okay.
Right. So people are a little bit more cautious now. So they're not getting into bikes by buying a brand new bike.
Right.
Okay. I mean, and, you know, it is true that, you know, the middle class is disappearing a little bit as well at the same time, at least right now. So, you know, yeah, you're going to get less people buying new bikes right now. But that just means that later on, when everyone's shitbox starter bike breaks down for good, well, it's a little bit more of a priority for them to buy a new bike, right? Someone has to buy them, right? And when all the old bikes turn to shit, like, they will buy them. They will. So there you go.
Especially when you look at what most of the used bikes on the market are right now, which don't have ABS, don't have any of the fancy features like traction control, don't have especially cornering ABS, aren't fuel injected. When you look at all of the things, when you look at how less mechanically savvy the younger generations are, and the feature list you're missing out on a 10-year-old bike, you know, you're always going to start small and you're going to start modest if you're in college or you just got out of college or you just got a job and you just scrape together what cash you could to get a bike. It's always going to be modest. But, you know, after 3-4 years when you've really done everything you can with that bike and then it just breaks down, you're going to think, I could have a bike with a warranty. I could have ABS. I could have all of these cool features. And then you realize that, oh, because all these used bikes have now been bought up and everyone's been holding out and kept using up these old bikes, now it's only like $3,000 more for a brand new super sport or the brand new mid-sized adventure bike or touring bike. And that comes with a 2-year warranty. Like, it's going to shift back. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. I mean, so if you're like, if you have the absolute, like, most limited amount of purchasing power for a new bike right now, we were talking earlier, you know, you're 16, you're 17, you've got a summer job or something, right? You can save up and buy yourself a Ninja 250, and it's like maybe the coolest thing you could be riding to your high school, right? If you had a really nice, clean, well-sorted Ninja 250 and you're 17 or whatever, there you go, right? And that's like your bottom of the barrel, gonna spend the least amount of money, you know. Well, yeah, entry-level rider, right? And then the opposite end of the spectrum is 45 to 55 midlife crisis, goes out to the store and buys a V4 Panigale. Or Harley Ultra Limited touring thing. Or a brand new fully loaded Goldwing, right? So these are your two extreme opposites, right? Now, before the crash, the stock market crash, it was just way more of the Panigale buyers, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know why everyone's so shocked that there's been this flip, right? Because when everyone buys all these new bikes suddenly and then has to unload them, there's that many cheap used bikes on the market. And, well, you're a sucker if you buy a brand new one, right?
Well, it's the same as an oil well opening up in your town. It's like, you're going to buy a new F-150, wait 3 months until the oil workers aren't getting paid anymore, and one of those shiny new F-250s you see rolling around town can be yours for pennies on the dollar.
Right. Well, and every motorcycle podcast, like, 2.5-3 years ago was talking about how you're a sucker if you buy a new bike. They're like, who are these people buying new bikes? Like, go on Craigslist and get this, that you're way better off that way. Or they're even expounding on the virtues of buying an old bike and turning into a cafe racer or doing whatever, right? Like, why would I get a brand new whatever? I can get an old CB750 and fix it up and it's all that I need and da-da-da-da-da-da, right? Cleveland Moto, I love them. They were very guilty of this, right? And now everyone's all butthurt that no one's buying new bikes. Well, no, they just listened to you, right? They just listened to, like, good sense advice. Like, yeah, don't buy a brand new bike as your first bike, right? Because guess what? In the last 10 years, a lot of people, like, hung up their helmets, right? And now a lot of, like, younger kids are getting into it, right? I believe that the average age of a motorcyclist has come down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's still a very high age overall, because you still got a lot of guys hanging out doing the thing that they've always done, right? You know, when we went down to MotoGP, right? We're both over 30. And we were kind of the younger crowd there, right?
Yeah.
You know, and we're talking about motorcycle racing, right? This should be something that's very much like a young man's game, right?
I feel like if you ride around town, you know, at some point you, like, if you ride over to the mall or something to go to a store, like, you realize that, like, motorcycle enthusiasm peaks at about 5.5 years old.
Yeah.
And then, like, rapidly declines. And then picks up somewhere around 25.
Right. So, I don't know. Just it's a situation that makes a lot of sense to me, because never before have you had, like, such a large generation change as the baby boomers swapping over to the next generation, right? Which has its own special math that comes into play. Then you have an economic crash to go along with that. You also have a big styling change within the industry itself. And you have all these, you know, strange financial repercussions that are, you know, there's echoes of financial moves that were made decades ago, not just from the most recent financial crash, but from those before. All these forces coming together to create this perfect storm that, of course, is going to slow new bike sales for a while, right? With a flooded old market, weird economic conditions, and a generation change, it's gonna happen.
I do think, though, that I think it'll happen about 8 years from now. I think that with the increased obsession with safety in our culture, you know, with all the concerns around, like, concussions in the NFL and everyone always wearing a helmet, like, while they're skiing, and like the notion of a kid going to school on his bicycle and not wearing a helmet, like, just being unfathomable, the introduction of self-driving cars. I think culturally, I think it's going to happen 6 to 8 years from now. There's going to be a huge generational backlash against it. And I think we're going to see a massive flood of new riders.
Oh, it's going to become rebellious again.
Yes.
Okay, because right now it's like, yeah, your dad rides a motorcycle, whatever. Like, it's yeah, what could you do that's more dorky than ride a motorcycle right now?
Right.
Okay. So, yeah, so you're saying, all right, it's going to be viewed as that much more dangerous again, and therefore be super cool.
Yes.
I don't disagree with that. But if you're talking about a societal shift and a change of view,
I think it's a generational shift.
Right. Does it take that long?
Well,
I mean, things move so quickly in culture now. If that's going to happen, I mean, could it be like 4 years?
At the surface level, things change very quickly. But I think if you look at the underlying currents and what's really driving a lot of the top level stuff, it is still very steady and it is very cyclical. And I think, I mean, we have people dousing themselves in rubbing alcohol and lighting themselves on fire and people eating Tide Pods. Like, this is the 13 to 16 year old culture we live in right now. Like, people are eating detergent and posting it to Instagram. In 6 to 8 years, they're going to be financially independent and be on their own health insurance and be able to buy a motorcycle and not ask anyone for permission. Think about that.
Yeah. You know, at the same time, like, you know, a lot of people are really, like, harsh on millennials. And I don't know, I take a little bit of exception to that. I don't consider myself a millennial.
We're kind of right on the border.
Well, okay, I've mentioned this to you before. I think the definition of millennial, no one really wants to just come out and say. But the real proper definition of a millennial is when you were in middle school, did you have access to streaming internet porn? or was it available to your age range? You know, like if you were just super poor and didn't have a phone or whatever, or a computer or whatever, that doesn't count. But, you know, if by that time, was it a thing, right? You're a millennial. If you didn't, then, you know, in your adolescence, did you have access to internet porn? And if the answer is no, all right? And, okay, let's say you did, but it was 56K modem, you're still not a millennial, right? All right. If you
were downloading, like, Playboy scans off of a BBS board, doesn't count.
Right. Yeah, you're exempt. Don't worry. If it was faster to print the image than it was to actually load it on your monitor,
I have the perfect, the most precise cutoff point ever.
Okay.
So middle school or high school, doesn't matter. If you had access to porn, but you were willing, because of the accessibility at home, if you were more willing to take the chance to print it off at school, you're right on the cusp, but you're not a millennial.
There we go. So again, I take exception. I'm not in the millennial thing. But I'm on the cusp, but I'm definitely not. And I don't identify with the things they identify with and their values. I definitely lean more towards Gen X. I mean, I rented Reality Bites from Blockbuster. Okay. So I'm definitely closer to Gen X than I am to the millennials, but, the people get down on them. Right. And they're getting down, you know, there was these kids, their cell phones and their new, like there are sixes in their cell phones. And they're just a bunch of dudes that don't want to take on a huge amount of debt right now. Right.
Yeah.
I don't know what all the hatred is like. Oh, and they don't know how to fix their bikes. Yeah. Because they just got them. Right.
Yeah.
I defy any old fart to tell me when they got their first bike, they knew everything about how to fix it. Fuck off. Every story I've ever heard is, well, I got this old Yamaha DT100, someone else who crashed it, and I got it for like, you know, like 8 weeks of mowing lawns. And man, I learned everything there is to know about working on bikes by rebuilding that thing. They weren't, but if you're 68 years old right now, you weren't born knowing how to fix a motorcycle. At this point, maybe it's been so fucking long that you think you were, but you weren't. Someone taught you. And hey, maybe the reason that millennials don't know how to fix their own bikes is because, like, baby boomers have been too goddamn lazy to teach their kids how to do it. Because guess what? You're not born knowing how to fix your goddamn bike. I really, you know, I will definitely, you know, bash hipsters on bikes all day long. But millennials on bikes? I don't think so. Like, I'm really just tired of hearing people just harp on about it. And it doesn't, none of the arguments hold any water at all.
So here's my counterpoint to all of the accusation, you know, all of the ageism against millennials in particular, and kind of where the criticism is coming from. And this is when we were on our way down to Austin. Dad had his new sound system and his new infotainment system in the F-150.
Yeah.
And he had figured out, oh, I can use Android Auto on this and get voice commands through the sound system and make calls and select music and get navigation. Oh, isn't this fancy?
So fancy.
So I'm driving. And we're coming up on, you know, the agreed 200 miles where we were going to swap over, and you were on the bike and we needed to call you.
Right.
So you had just called us and said you were going to find a place to stop, and we were going to call you when we got into Lubbock.
Yes.
And we were going to meet you on the far side. Mm-hmm. We're in downtown Lubbock.
Right.
Like, and we're just getting off and headed your way. And it's like, okay, well, in the next 5 miles, Peter's going to be here somewhere. So we've got to stop. And he's like, oh, well, let's just call him. And he hits the button that you have to press because it's some Kenwood.
Right.
Or a Pioneer system that you've got to press a button. You can't just talk. It's not listening all the time.
Right.
And he hits it and says, call Peter. And it doesn't go through. And of course, it takes 5 seconds each time.
Right.
And he doesn't get it. I'm like, okay, just... okay, so here's the thing. This is something that any person under the age of 40 could figure out in about 2.5 seconds. Which is, there's 5 buttons along the bottom of the screen. There's one for navigation. There's one for selecting your music. There's one for calling people. Like... and then there's like a settings menu and some other thing. And like, that's it. And lo and behold, if you hit the phone button, it'll show your contacts and your call history. And it'll show your call history, newest to oldest. And of course, you had just called us. So he was actually on the phone screen at the time. And there was your name right at the top of the screen. And he was hitting this button to say your name.
In the extra step.
Yeah. And it messed up like a couple times. And after a while, I was like, can you just push the button and call Peter? Like, I've been willing to entertain this ridiculous affair for like 3 minutes now. I just push the button. Just it's right there. Just push the button. I don't know. You're already leaning over the dash as it is. Like, it's like, I don't know why it took so long, but it was okay, fine. And then it's like, well, you do it then. It's like, boom.
Right.
we're calling Peter. Look at that. just push the button. Please. Please just push the button. It's right there. Just click on his name.
Right. Yeah, and it was strange too, because, like, you know, I feel like, you know, for our age, our generation, our time, you know, we know far more. Well, whilst we don't know as much as, you know, Dad knows about engines, obviously, we know far more than most people we know and most people our age.
Yeah.
And we can do many more tasks, maintenances, and fixes than most. Whilst we're definitely not full-on qualified mechanics by any stretch, there's a lot more we can handle than other people can handle. And there's a thing where, like, I remember we were looking at a Goldwing and this bike comes by and I'm like, oh, is that one of those, like, two-stroke Hondas or whatever? And, like, you know, and then these two old guys look at us like, oh, these kids, they don't know about two-strokes. Like, well, okay, whatever. Like, I mistook a bike real quick. But, like, could you have gotten anywhere close to identifying what that 80s, you know, Honda dirt bike is? Because I got pretty close, but, you like, come on. Like, I don't know. The ageism has become a really weird, like, super acceptable thing both ways right now. And I definitely feel it's more harsh against younger people right now, especially millennials. If you're 21 right now or 22, you're a dude and you're getting into bikes, apparently everybody fucking hates you. I'm not sure how cool that is.
Ironically, it's a lot of the same people who are lamenting the death of the motorcycle industry.
Right. Which isn't going to die. It's like, but it's way more popular as a means of transportation worldwide than cars are. Okay? You know? Like, we happen to be a minority here in the United States. Worldwide, we're the cool kids. Okay? Like, there are fewer car drivers worldwide than people that get around on moped, bicycle, motorcycle, whatever. Like, there really is just something about driving cars that makes them all assholes. And you know, and worldwide, you know, it's not old people riding motorcycles either. It's people from every walk of life. So this idea that, like, you've put in your miles and you've paid your dues and you've done some oil changes or whatever, and younger people aren't legit riders. I don't know. Fuck off, basically, is all I want to say. Fuck off. Everyone started somewhere. Even you. You sour old bastard. You know? So, I don't know. That's all I got to say about that, really. Just cheer up, you know? Embrace electric bikes. No one's forcing you, right? Don't worry. You're going to have your clutch lever as long as you want it. It's fine.
I do remember the guy, an old guy who lives around here. Who knows if he's even still alive at this point. When he saw the W650... Well, I was messing around with it. He came by, and the only thing he had to say, looking at seeing that it was a kickstart, was his only in here, and his only topic of conversation was seeing somebody else with a kickstart gave him, in his mind, permission to lament the invention of electric start, because it made motorcycling accessible to women.
Never mind that that's something that happened in the late 50s. Yeah. Right? The Electroglide used to be called, like, the something else glide. It became the Electroglide because they gave it electric start in, like, 57 or something like that, right? So even in Harleys, even in, like, antiquated bikes, right? Honda was putting electric start on shit in, like, 1961, right? And before that, they were doing like really crazy systems where instead of just straight kickstarting it, you would like ratchet up a spring with a series of smaller kicks and then release it all, right? In an effort to you create a better starting system, right?
I can't imagine what it would have been like to kickstart like a 650 single in like the 1930s.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what's the kickback on one of those? That would have been brutal. How many people broke their legs doing that, right? You know, if you're like Henry Ford put electric start on his cars because someone he knew was crank starting a Ford. It kicked back, smacked him in the forehead, and killed him. Right?
Yeah.
And that that happened to loads of people. Then it happened to someone Henry Ford knew, and so he put electric start on the cars. Because guess what? It was a necessary thing. Like, the crank start was killing people. And you know what? Like, kickstart's cool. I've had kickstart bikes. It makes you feel really cool to kick it, and it's a good skill to have. Just sort of understanding how the motor works and being that connected to how it's starting. It's cool and it's worthwhile knowing how to do and do properly. And, you know, there's still a lot of dirt bike kids that do it all the time and are like way better than old people who think they know everything there is to know about kickstarting, right? Or my buddy Steve, who's got that 500 bullet. Man, I'm good at kickstarting bikes. Only Steve can get that thing to kick on the first try. And he does almost every single time. It amazes the hell out of me. And I forgot where I was going again. But whatever. Electric start, why it's good. You kill a kickstart bike in traffic and it's kickstart only. That's a dangerous situation. Right? Trying to kickstart a bike again in the middle of an intersection. I had to do it on the CB350. There's people honking. There's everyone's looking at you like cars going by. You have no ability to move and you need to get this bike started again. Like, you want to start it now and get out of that dangerous situation. Electric start is 100% better than kickstart in every way, except that, okay, you can kickstart a bike with a dead battery. But you know what? You can bump start a bike too. So it's not really even that superior that way. So it's just a way to bump start a bike when it's standing still. This is technology from the 1800s. Like, I don't see why someone needs to think that a bike's illegitimate because it's electric start only. Electric start's been around for quite a long time now, and it's been a standard for quite a long time.
Yeah, I don't actually know if there are any people still alive who actually predate electric start.
Not many.
Not a lot.
So, there we go. All right, we're at quite a bit of time now. We're probably creeping up on 2 hours. It's probably a good time to end this. Got anything else we want to bring up?
Lots, but we can move on.
We'll save it for another episode.
Yeah.
So we've been grumpy about people who are grumpy about other things on this podcast. All right. Remember, you can email us at nokomotopodcast@gmail.com. Please leave us ratings and reviews on iTunes because it's the bomb when you guys do it. Not many people have yet, but some people have. And trust me, it helps us so much. And we love you and care about you. And we hope you have a wonderful day. And with that, stay safe and stay tuned. We are going to do the outro.
And I don't want to die, just want to ride on my